Welcome to another Avcon WOW Aviation Consulting Company podcast hosted by myself, Paul Richmond. Podcasts aim to bring interesting and relevant news and information to podcast listeners about things and issues that matter to the aviation industry. For those of us so fortunate to be part of this industry, we can say that it is never routine that all of its participants need to be able to turn on a dime as we navigate through new challenges on a recurring basis. On today's show, we're honored to be able to welcome industry veteran and manager of the Oshawa Executive Airport in the city of Oshawa, Mr. Stephen Wilcox. Thank you, Stephen, for being part of today's show.
Well, good afternoon, Paul, and it's nice to join you.
Awesome. So we got lots of things we want to cover off today for the listeners, and I know you well, and I'm very happy that you're here with us today. So, first of all, can you share with the listeners something about your career in the aviation business, what it's also like to own and fly your own aircraft?
Yeah, thanks very much, Paul. I've really been fortunate to be in this industry, either as a user of it or a participant, for many, many years. I started flying back in the 70s. There was a flying club at my local high school in Scarborough, Ontario, and joined the club and learned to fly. And really have never looked back, just absolutely loved it. In the late 70s, I started an air service, did fly-in fishing trips and scenic flights, and became a bush pilot, a float plane pilot, and really enjoyed that component. And then really early 90s, I moved off into some other business ventures, but always had aircraft in the mix. You know, airplanes make the world very small. And so for many years, I had a small twin and traveled all over North America for business with that aircraft. And then in 2006, I joined the Oshawa Executive Airport here. And in fact, my company, Total Aviation and Airport Solutions, operates and manages the airport on behalf of the city of Oshawa. And I have enjoyed my time here. It's a great challenge. And really been fortunate to be in aviation. And I've always had an airplane. That's the great thing about both operating an air service, but also the businesses that I've had and traveling. And today I continue to operate a float plane with a friend and really enjoy just getting out and flying. And today's a wonderful sunny day here in Oshawa, so it's very tempting to be out flying every day that I sit here in Oshawa, actually.
Well, that's pretty exciting, and I have seen you fly from point A to point B, so that's really awesome. I've actually had a chance to fly with you, and I will attest to our listeners, you're an excellent, cautious, experienced pilot, which gives your passengers much comfort. The region of Durham and Oshawa City continues to grow in leaps and bounds, given the Oshawa Airport, some 484 acres in size, situated within easy reach of the community. Please describe for the listeners the magnitude, scope, and services offered at your airport.
Well, thanks, Paul. I'll start by letting everyone know that the Oshawa Airport was stood up by the Canadian Forces at the beginning of World War II as one of the British Commonwealth air training bases. And post-war, it became continued to be a military base for some time and then moved into general aviation. Most recently, it operates as an executive airport on the east side of the Greater Toronto Area. And so we have two runways here. We have a primary runway, 4,250 feet long, secondary runway, a multitude of taxiways and aprons. We have about 200 aircraft here, about 18 aviation businesses, and really focusing on that executive component. So it's very common for us to see corporate aircraft coming and going. We have medevac aircraft that are based here that come and go, as well as the flight schools and general aviation. So we really encapsulate a lot of the interesting pieces of aviation.
Wow, a really thriving hub there that you have going. Airports are known to bring and help enable economic prosperity to local community. Can you share with the listeners how your airport supports this important benefit to the community that it serves?
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. And just to put it in context, you know, any component of infrastructure of value, the social and economic benefits must exceed the social and economic costs. And so social benefit are things like the medevacs. There's five hospitals in Durham region that we support, and several of them have helicopter pads, but the aircraft can only go to the helipads in good weather, And of course, a lot of trauma is car accidents, and car accidents happen often in bad weather. So very common for us to see the medevac aircraft coming and going, either the helicopters or, you know, patient transfers, those types of operations. And so that what we'd call social fabric. But also having a resource like this in the community for the Air Cadet program, and we have two Air Cadet groups here in Durham Region, both of them call the Oshawa Airport their home. So again, great social fabric for the young people that are involved in the Air Cadets. And then, of course, we have the 420 Wing, which is the Air Force's equivalent to the Legion based here at the airport. And again, many veterans and veteran supporters are members there. So again, really important social fabric. And in fact, the south side of the airport is a key heritage component in the city of Oshawa. And we also have the Ontario Regiment here, which is Canada's largest mechanized tank museum. So they're the place where we curate the history of Canada. So we curate both the rich aviation heritage that it had, but also this combined heritage of the Ontario Regiment. So again, that's huge social fabric, right? And of course, just our local flying clubs with our pilots that come together and enjoy this thing of flying. And those are the kind of things we talk about as social benefits. And then, of course, economic benefits are very, very important. And the airport generates about $100 million in GDP each year. And that's pretty significant. Now, GDP is one of those funny things. If you love airports or you need to get on a medevac, then GDP is really important. But if you live close to the airport, then you may not like the noise of airplanes. And that would be a negative social factor. So it's always that balance. But certainly we have a significant social and economic benefit here to the airport. The airport generates about $1.6 million in direct property tax just from the businesses on the airport or the former airport lands. So all of that contributes to towards the operation. And the airport is totally self-funding from an operational perspective because of that property tax contribution. So great social benefit, great economic benefit in the terms of jobs, and we're very pleased to be able to support both the city of Oshawa, the region Durham, as well as really the East GTA. Many of our pilots and users and businesses are sort of east of the middle of Toronto, east of Yonge Street. We're a common base of operation for them. So very pleased to be able to do that.
It's pretty fascinating that you also have not one but two Air Cadet squadrons who base themselves at Oshawa Airport. I mean, after all, the youth are the leaders for tomorrow. And, you know, to get them interested in aviation now, so when they become of age, they can continue with the importance of aviation, whether it be as a pilot or whether as an AME or whether as making sure that aviation is part of their company. Very important, so that's excellent that you're able to do that. In Ontario, there's a service known as Orange. Can you share with the listeners what critical service this agency provides and the role that Oshawa Airport plays to enable this all-important service?
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. So Orange basically is responsible for the movement of all patients in the province of Ontario. And so if you fall down and break your leg somewhere and they take you to a local hospital but they can't treat you there, then they're the ones that would send either a ground ambulance or an air ambulance to move you to a center that that could actually look after you. And they're responsible for all of that movement of people. And what we figured out many years ago now and how Orange came to be was that if you were in a hospital, let's say somewhere in Ontario, that they couldn't provide and you needed surgery, and they couldn't provide that surgery in a timely manner there, they figured out that it's far better for your health and for the way the system works to actually put you in an airplane and move you to a hospital that can provide that service. And then also in Ontario, we have centers of excellence, medical centers of excellence. And here in Oshawa, we have a cancer center of excellence. So they deal with a large portion of southeastern Ontario's cancer patients come here to Oshawa to that center of excellence. In Rouge Valley, just outside of Durham Region on the east side of Toronto, is a cardiac center of excellence. So again, Orange will move people around to bring them to those various medical centers of excellence. And then one of the other key roles that Orange fulfills is, of course, the immediate trauma. You know, there's a car accident and they have the ability to, you know, land a helicopter on the highway and take take the patient to a trauma center. And as I mentioned earlier, if they happen to be unable to get to the highway, they're going to put them in an ground ambulance, bring them to an airport, and then move them. And so again, in Oshawa, as we look after Durham Region for that component. And the last piece that they do, of course, is organ transplants. And organ transplants are a very important component of the way our medical system works. Here in Ontario, we're very, very fortunate. And here in Oshawa's case, we actually have a fleet of small jet aircraft that do the majority of the organ transplant flights for any donors or recipients in Ontario. And depending on which organ it is it a heart, is it a liver, is it a lung, it varies. And often there'll be more than one airplane because they're, you know, the donor organs may be going to various locations. But they'll launch an aircraft out of here, and if the donor was in Halifax and the recipient was in London, Ontario, they'll often fly to London, pick up a recovery team, fly to Halifax, recover the organs, back to London and back to here. And they do that for pretty much all of the recipients or donors in Ontario as it relates to organ transplants. So great organization, Orange, and we're very fortunate here in Ontario to have them. And I know a lot of jurisdictions across Canada and across the globe are learning how they do it and trying to emulate them. So just a great organization.
Wow, that's quite the service. And I wonder how many other people can say that they have such an intertwined critical service at their airport to be able to support the people far and wide as Oshawa does. Let's move on to a slightly different topic. And given that the city owns the airport, how does this translate into how an airport is managed and run? I mean, you did allude to it earlier on and today. Perhaps you can give us a bit more detail.
Yeah, and so the Oshawa Airport was originally owned by the federal government, as I said, stood up as a British Commonwealth Air Training Base. And it was owned by the federal government until 1997. And in the late 90s, Paul, as you'll recall, the federal government was divesting itself of all of its ownership of airports. Now, in Oshawa's case, they owned it, but they didn't operate it. The city kind of operated it and had a few different departments try to run it. But airports are of real specialty, right? And the city, quite honestly, struggled to operate it within their own organizational structure, as many do. And across Canada, of course, we see airport authorities, we see standalone, you know, boards of governance. In Oshawa's case, the city continues to own the airport, but in 97, they went out to outside expertise to come in. So in our case here, we operate it and we manage it. So we're physically the operator of the airport. The city owns the airport, and we manage a budget to manage the facility. All of the revenue ultimately goes to the city, and as do the expenses, and they pay us a component to manage that. But it's a very, very efficient way because we're able to bring economies of scale and expertise that that the city is unable to do on their own. So it makes for a very efficient operational model here in for the Oshawa Airport.
Well, certainly, as an outsider, I can certainly vouch for anyone who's listening. The airport is exceptionally well managed and well run based on any feedback I got from tenants and within the aviation community itself. So, Steve, with you and your team, excellent job and well done. To move on, please share with the listeners an overview of the airside structure, layout, air traffic control services that the airport offers to flight crews and aircraft owners.
Yeah, so we're very fortunate here in Oshawa. We're on 484 acres, as you mentioned earlier, Paul, but we are right within the, almost the city, in the middle of the city of Oshawa these days. And so we have really focused on that executive component. And so we, as I mentioned earlier, we do have a primary runway. We have a secondary runway. We have GPS approaches right down to 250 feet, which is, in technical terms, we call that a non-precision approach, but 249 is precision, so we're right knocking on the door. And that allows the aircraft to come and go virtually in all weather conditions here. We do are very fortunate that we have a Nav Canada control tower here, and they staff the airport from 6:30 in the morning till 10:30 at night. And so they manage all of the traffic arrivals and departures here at the airport. We're very sophisticated when it comes to snow and how we manage the winter environment, especially because of the medevacs. It's very common for us to get a medevac departure for an organ transplant on 1 or 2 hours' notice in the middle of the night, in the middle of a snowstorm. As I mentioned, you know, they typically come from traumas, from car crashes, and that happens in bad weather. So we operate the airport 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And we make sure that both the corporate and the important medevac flights can come and go on a 24-hour basis. And that's something that's unique to us. So you think of a big airport like Pearson, they're running at 24 hours and they're used to that. But many regional airports may only have scheduled service and they might not have a flight till 7 in the morning. And of course, today with COVID, we're seeing a limited number of regional airports with service because of that, you know, standing down for a while because of COVID. So they may come in and plow the snow at 7, where we're here 24 hours a day making sure that we maintain the infrastructure. The other thing that's unique to us is that with a runway length of only 4,250 feet of pavement, I can tell you that the corporate aircraft and the medevac flights want 4,250 feet of dry pavement or clear pavement. And so if you have longer runways, your runway condition can be a little bit poorer because you get some extra room for braking. But with such a short runway, we really work diligently to make sure we can give them the very best runway to keep them going, even in those inclement weather-type operations. And all of that feeds into, again, making sure that business and the medevacs can go, as well as our other clients, our flight training clients, and our GA clients, our recreational clients as well.
How many trucks do you have to help support the snow clearing operation?
Well, we run about 6 pieces of equipment, Paul, during a snow event, and we run the same equipment that that you would see at Pearson Airport. So we run large, sophisticated equipment to maintain our runways. And in aviation, of course, we like redundancy. We like backup. So we have, you know, 2 large trucks with brooms, 2 blowers, 2 apron plows. We tend to double up chemical sprayers to put chemical down on the runway, de-icing chemical, that sort of thing. So we run a fairly sophisticated winter operation there.
So just kind of build on what you just shared with the listeners, customers can choose to base their aircraft anywhere within the GTHA. So why do people choose to base their aircraft out to Oshkosh? Is that kind of airport versus another airport? Are there any particular reasons that you haven't already mentioned that you can share with the listeners?
Well, I think, Paul, you know, businesses and individuals will always put their aircraft at the best location for them, given the services that that they would like to see. And so one of the things we have found is, in particular, because of the way we do our focus on business and corporate and the medevac aviation, we do have a lot of corporate aircraft traffic that have migrated to us in the past really 5 and 6 years. And because of that level of service we provide around all weather. In 2017, we spent just a little over $6 million rehabilitating our main runway. So we have LED lighting. We're a Class 5 TP5th edition runway. We're one of the few in Canada yet that have moved to the most recent edition. We have runway and safety areas. And we have good clear approaches, as I mentioned, GPS approaches right down essentially to minimums. And so if you're a corporate aircraft operator, business aircraft operator or a medevac operator, that's very, very attractive to you. But it's also very attractive for the flight schools and for the recreational flyers because, you know, if you've had a snow event overnight and now you've got a nice day following it, they'll want to get out flying. And if you're not providing a level of service that keeps your airport open all the time, they can't fly. So we have a lot of people that come to us because of that operation. Now it's a bit of a mixed blessing. We do not have scheduled passenger service, and that's because of our proximity to Toronto, to the GTAA. And but it does give us a benefit of being able to focus on the other types of aviation. So we have a lot of people that move here because we have the control tower, because we provide excellent level of service, because we communicate really well. Before every snow event, we do a broadcast email that goes out to all of our users, over about 400 now, and we tell them exactly what we think the weather is going to be and exactly what our snow plan is and what they can expect. And we ask them, if you need to fly and you're going to be flying in this period of bad weather, you tell us what you need and when you're going, and we'll make sure we can do our very best to give it to you. So that level of communication and service, people will come and they'll go, oh my gosh, we've never seen communication like this at an airport. And it's really kind of collaborative decision-making, Paul, because when we're trying to decide how best to operate the airport, how best to deal with our snow plans, when to do scheduled maintenance for crack sealing and line painting in the summer, we talk to our users. and we work with them to find schedules that work. And it's that collaborative process, I think, is what makes us very attractive, probably the most, you know, one of the most attractive airports in Canada.
Very impressive, Steve. Shifting the topic just slightly, what types of shops or maintenance facilities are available at the airport, and can you share any notable success or interesting stories with the listeners around that line?
Yeah, very much, Paul. We're fortunate, as I mentioned, we have 18 aviation businesses here, and ranging in expertise as it relates to aircraft, from the small GA aircraft right up to the large Falcon jets. In fact, we have a Falcon jet service center, and the Falcon jet aircraft come from all over Canada to be maintained here. One of the operators also operates the BT, the Basler BT-67, which is the big turbine converted DC-3. They operate that all over the globe. In fact, they should be in Antarctica right now, flying the scientists around. That's their summer, our winter. That's suspended for this year, but they operate those aircraft, so great expertise there. But we also have the Eastern Canada service facility for TBM aircraft, so though it's a single-engine turbine aircraft, as well as a Cirrus Service Center. We have Eastern Canada sales and maintenance facility for Piper, Diamond, Gypsero, and Kodiak aircraft. So it's wonderful for me with a background in float plane flying, because I get to see the shiny new Kodiak aircraft coming and going on the big floats, and of course widely used across the country as water bombers. And so again, we're very fortunate that we have a lot of successes here with all of the businesses. One of our businesses, Corporate Aircraft Restoration, is well known around the globe and here in Canada for maintaining vintage aircraft, and they maintain a fleet of vintage aircraft, so it's not uncommon for us to see those aircraft coming in to be maintained. So really nifty. In fact, they're now looking after a P-51 Mustang. Wow. And so that frequents our airport, and along with the typical Harvards and the Chipmunks and the Tiger Moths. And so not only are we spanning little airplanes to big corporate jets, we're spanning, you know, old airplanes, 40s and 30s airplanes, to the latest and greatest brand new airplanes. So it's a from an airport manager's perspective, looking out the window, it's wonderful to be able to see that. If you were a bird watcher, you want to be in the forest around birds. If you're an airplane watcher and an airplane lover, you want to be watching my window. Hard to work some days, Paul.
Yeah, I bet it is, eh? All these beautiful distractions. You see these amazing historical aircraft or most modern aircraft taxi by your window. So I guess one of the benefits, too, of all these maintenance facilities is good-paying jobs for people who live in Durham region.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The airport is one of the largest employers in Durham region. When you look at all of the jobs, I didn't really talk about that, but direct and indirect, we have somewhere close to 500 jobs here at the airport. And the jobs, as you say, aircraft mechanics, pilots, flight instructors, full-time. We have two very large flight schools here with full-time flight instructors. That's their chosen career, of course, as well as the lines people, you know, the people that are marshaling the airplanes and moving the airplanes, all aspects of aviation here. Most certainly, as well as the dispatchers, you know, the Basler BT-67s that fly all over the globe, are managed from here. So they have a command center for them, and they track them around the globe, and they dispatch them around the globe from a center that's here. And the crews all cycle through our facility here every 3 months. They're typically on the aircraft for 3 months and off. And so wide spectrum of great paying jobs, just and really enjoyable jobs. I think that's the most important piece, right? You need to get up in the morning and like what you do. And I think aviation, you know, we know it's a bit complex, but most of the people that are in it really enjoy it because of that complexity. So great paying and really enjoyable jobs. That's an important piece.
Wow, that's very attractive for people who live in Durham region. As you say, if you're passionate about aviation, there are many opportunities for interested people at Oshawa Airport. As you mentioned, whether it be pilots or aircraft maintenance engineers or dispatch or aircraft servicing. So changing the topic, many airports have some residents living in the airport's general area don't necessarily appreciate aircraft movements into and out of a local airport. How do you and your team manage any concerns raised by members of the local community?
Yeah, so Oshawa is very unique in this, and we actually have 14,000 residential you know, homes or apartments within 2 kilometers. That's in the first 2 kilometers.
Wow.
And there's only one other city in Canada with more houses than us. And just to put it in perspective, when you look at an airport like Waterloo, they only have about 7,500 houses, 8,000 houses within 2 kilometers. So we're really saturated around us. And aircraft noise has always been an issue here because of that highly populated area around us. And Oshawa recently was named the best city outside of the core of Toronto in the Toronto area to live. And so we're seeing those numbers grow and the population and the number of residences around us grow. Now, they're typically outside that 2 kilometer radius, but 2 kilometers really just deals with the aircraft circuit, but you need to get out to that 10 kilometer and 20 kilometer for the approaches. So when we look at those numbers, they're very, very high. And so in our case here, we have a number of noise and traffic management strategies in place to manage the airport in a respectful manner of the community. And when we get the inquiries, we make sure we convey what we do for the community at its present stand. And it's an evolution, Paul. As the aircraft change and the traffic volumes change, that process is continuing to go forward. In fact, we're going forward with a process that actually went to our Development Services Committee here on Monday, this past Monday. We'll go to council in a week and a half, that basically gets direction from them to move forward with a new process to establish some additional measures for noise and traffic management, because we're really committed to finding that balance. It's really important to recognize the role that the airport has, the social and economic benefit, but also to recognize the impact, that negative social impact, and in terms of noise. And it's a really challenging one, Paul. We have people that live right beside the airport that never notice, and we have other people that do notice. And it's very important that we work with them to try to minimize the impact as great as we possibly can. Part of that strategy under this report that's gone forward will be to look at working with our flight training schools at what new technologies are out there that we could bring in to lessen the noise of the aircraft, you know, changes in exhausts and changes in propellers, and should we be looking at electric aircraft? They're beginning to emerge, just at their infancy. It's also looking at making sure that we're looking at the piston aviation fuel today. Paul, 100 low lead has lead in it. It's the only place we use lead in fuel. Mm-hmm. And there are strategies at a global level to remove that lead. And we've made a commitment that we'll be one of the first airports to have non-leaded fuel here. So it's really important to work with the community and understand that. 2019, we undertook a fairly comprehensive noise and air quality study here on the airport, and got some baseline data of what that's like literally right at the ends of the runway, where the concentration and noise levels would be the highest. And then this summer, we're taking that study out into the community. So we've mapped all of our noise-sensitive areas, and we're going to put those air and noise quality monitors out in the community so that we can have real live data that helps us understand exactly what they experience, exactly what the impacts are like on air quality, and what the noise impacts are. So again, I think it's a matter of working with the community, but it's a slow process, Paul, and that's the one piece I'd stress, is that you know, there's no light switch that we can flip to make changes, and we need to make sure we're, of course, consulting with all the users as we bring these changes forward. So it's going to take us some time to go through the next evolution, but we're looking forward to that, and I think it will, again, help us make sure that we continue to maintain a very good balance between the operation of the airport and the community.
Well, it's very impressive, Stephen, as to your plans you do have to move it forward, and as you say, it's a gradual, step-by-step process, but the fact you're doing it in consultation with the various stakeholders, those that are very much for the airport and those sometimes who struggle with the airport, is really amazing. And wow, that's really awesome. An airport is a complex, multi-layered operation, as you and I well know, but perhaps listeners don't. Now, what type of management structure do you have to provide excellent service that you've described to safeguard the airport, and all within a constrained budget? How do you do that?
Well, of course, Paul, that's always one of the great challenges, and I think probably one of the things that we bring to the table as an independent business operating the airport and managing it is we're always really looking for efficiency and how do we operate the airport? How do we bring the very best resources to the very best use? And so we operate a very lean and very, very efficient, but very small team here from a management structure. I fill the role as the airport manager, and then I have a management team that consists of a manager of safety and compliance that really looks at just exactly what it sounds like. It's the safety management system, which is our risk-based approach to how we do things here at the airport, along with my operations manager, which does exactly what it sounds like, which of course is looks at that day-to-day operation. And how do we clear the snow? How do we cut the grass? How do we chase the birds? And how do we manage the staff in a very efficient manner? And then I also have an office administrator that looks after the financial side because we do all of the invoicing and pay all of the bills on behalf of the city. Now it's all transferred through to the city, but we're the administrator of it. So we administrate all of the land leases, all of the land licenses, and work with the city on all of the land sales. We have a unique model here, Paul, where the city will actually sell airport land for airport use specifically. And that allows businesses to move forward where they own the land and can own the building. And that's much more conventional type business thinking than long-term leases. And it's something that's unique to us in Oshawa. A few airports do it, but we were certainly the first to do it. And so we manage all of that, but it's very, very efficient. So it's really myself, a management team of three. But then we also have a great operational team, and we call our operational team duty managers as opposed to just operational staff. And that's because from the minute they come into the airport until they leave, they're really responsible for the care and the control, right? They're the ones that are going out onto the airfield, that are doing the airfield inspection, checking the airfield, the runways for debris and making sure the lights work. They're the ones that respond to the wildlife calls and making sure the area is free from wildlife birds so the aircraft can come and go. And they're also the ones that are looking after the snow removal piece of the puzzle. But it's that combination between operating and really managing, understanding the responsibility. And that model works extremely well for us, but it's very, very efficient. And we actually have a small team of four duty managers. And with those four people, we manage to staff the airport from 6 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night, 365 days of the year. And then in the winter months, we add three additional duty managers to the table. In fact, this year we've added some co-op students from Georgian College. We've used the co-op students on and off over the years, and great challenges for young people coming into aviation. Today, of course, because of COVID, the airports have really had to cut back, and so it's a real struggle for young people in the airport management program to find jobs. And so we were able to go to the co-op program this winter as an alternate to going on the street for people and bringing them in. And that's worked out extremely well. We've just had some great candidates. They're super keen. Yeah. It involves more investment in the terms of training for us. And so we have them doing the duty manager roles. And we've also want to round out their education. So we do an annual review of a number of our manuals. And we've tasked each one of them. We had five in total over the course of the winter because it's a semester change in December. So we had two pre-Christmas and three post. And so we've had them look at the manuals and understand some of the office side and the administrative and the safety side as well, just to round out their education here. And they're with us for another few weeks, of course, as winter winds down. So that's a great way that we staff up. And then the other thing we do from a staff perspective for snow events is we have a number of on-call people. We're very fortunate here. We have two flight schools, and that leaves a lot of flight instructors. And of course, when the airport's covered in snow or the weather's bad, they're not teaching flying. And so we learned a long time ago that it was very efficient to bring an instructor who's very familiar with the airport, and he knows what he wants the airport to look like after the snowstorm because he wants to go flying. And so we brought them in and we train them up as equipment operators and bring them in on a part-time basis, on an on-call basis to augment so we can launch that team of five or six people out there post-event. We typically run two or three during the event and then up to six post-event. And that's been great because, again, we've got people that are keen to be in aviation. They know where the lights are. They know where the taxiways are. They can work with the tower. They're used to communicating. They know what they want the product to look like at the end. You know, clear runways, no snow banks. And we just found it was far easier to teach those people how to operate equipment than it was to teach operators, you know, very capable snowplow operators, how we do things at the airport, of course, because it's not like a road, right? We don't use salt. We don't leave any snow banks. We got a light every 200 feet down the side of the runway. So it's not like a road where you just wing it off into the ditch, you know? And so that's a program we've been doing now for 10 years, and it's worked great for us. So we round up the team as we need additional expertise. And then, of course, we're very fortunate in the industry that we have a lot of great aviation expertise in the form of consultants and engineers. So we'll bring them in to assist with projects as we need them to. In fact, we'll bring in an aviation professional to do the update on our noise and traffic management plan as an independent body to be able to work between the users and the community. So we'll resource those outside things where we can. But again, very lean, very, very efficient, yet we deliver a very high level of service with a very small package.
Well, I really admire that, the fact that you're bringing the entire airport community together to work as a team and in partnership for the benefit of all involved. The example you gave of flight school instructors being actual operators of the equipment is really amazing. As you say, they know where the runways and taxiways are because they see it as part of their day-to-day task, and they have a vested interest in making the airport safe and operational faster than perhaps otherwise would. So, and that's a great lesson for others to be able to contemplate other airports as they think about how they can actually improve. So amazing, amazing work there. COVID-19, as we know, has hit many airports extra hard. What type of impact is this pandemic having on your airport?
Well, Paul, we've been very, very fortunate, you know, and I sort of got to wind the clock back to last spring, you know, March, when the pandemic really kind of ramped up to Canada, and we saw sort of a suspension of a lot of the flying activity. And of course, the passenger service continues to, you know, we hear in the news almost daily that there's continued reductions in service as they don't want us to travel. But in our case here, because we had such a large corporate base, such a large medevac base, and some specialty companies here, we're very fortunate. Even at the very beginning of it, when we started to park airplanes, we had our medevac fleet flying all over the globe to repatriate Canadians. So in April and May, we had a lot of corporate traffic. In fact, our corporate traffic actually was above normal at that time as they repatriated Canadians from around the globe. And we also have a company here that does airborne sensing. So they do aerial photography, cartography type work. And they were very busy in May and June. The province of Ontario retained them to fly and photograph most of Ontario because they were able to get into airspace because there weren't airplanes flying that they wouldn't normally be able to get into. Now, the flight schools were suspended really until the beginning of July, but the traffic was made up with other activity. And so, you know, there was certainly a decline, but not as much as we saw at other airports. And then along comes July, and the two flight schools stood back up and have been operating since with a large range of COVID-type measures to keep the students safe, to keep the instructors safe. And prior to the pandemic, of course, there was huge demand for pilots. There's still a global pilot shortage. And when we stand the industry back up, that shortage will still be there. And so both the schools continue to be very busy and continue to see new students coming into it, which is really promising because they recognize that, you know, we will get through this, and it's going to be 3 to 5 years, I think, but we will get through it, and there will be jobs, and there will still be a pilot shortage. So they tend to be very busy. The recreational pilots, of course, very important that they keep flying, and so they haven't been able to travel the way that they normally would. Even myself with my airplane, you know, we would normally do a couple trips around the province. We weren't able to do that. But we like to see them flying because that keeps them proficient, right? And they have proficiency requirements from Transport Canada that they need to do, you know, their 5 night flights a year and so many circuits or so many flights within the 30-day period to keep their license current. So we saw less activity, but still lots of activity. And again, we have about 200 airplanes here in Oshawa. And in fact, in 2019, we did 89,000 aircraft movements. And for those that don't know, every time an airplane takes off, or every time an airplane lands. That's called an aircraft movement. And when, so we did 89,000 movements in 2019. And that's growing in the last 5 years. We had a very long average, about 60,000 movements. And 16, 17, 18, 19, we grew it to 89,000. Last year we did just under 81,000 movements. So we saw a little dip, but a very, very little dip. Probably the area that continues to be the most impacted is the corporate flying. Right. So we're still seeing the medevac flights and still seeing patients been moved around the country, and even patients still coming back from overseas, because you may have been hospitalized in Europe, not able to leave the hospital to get a medevac flight back to Canada. So we still see those coming on. In fact, there's one coming in today. Now, with the current restrictions, of course, they'll need to go into Montreal or into Toronto, really Toronto, initially, and then they'll bring them back here to Oshawa afterwards, because we have now all international flights have to go to one of the four, Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, and Halifax, I believe it is.
And they'd be cleared onwards from there.
And cleared and go onwards, yeah. So we've seen that. The corporate traffic is down, but we see... that's really the only component for us. The GA and the flight training continues to be busy, but our corporate numbers absolutely are down. And we also saw a little bit of a slowdown in, quite honestly, some of the patient transfer and the organ flights, Paul. It's kind of back to normal now, but when we were sort of at the peak of the pandemic in the spring and they weren't sure how they were going to manage the medical system and whether we were going to, fill the hospitals with COVID patients, there was sort of a suspension of non-essential medical operations. So if you need to get your hip done, you're going to wait. But there was also a reduction in the organ transplant flights. So I think they were looking at that, recognizing that, what the exposure was. So there was a little bit of a reduction in that. But today we seem to be back to, I want to call normal kind of activity, normal activity levels.
So, Stephen, as we round out our interview together today, you are a well-seasoned veteran in the aviation industry. As you look back over your impressive career, is there a particular time or moment that stood out for you as either extra challenging or memorable that you can share with our listeners?
Yeah, thanks very much, Paul. And that's a great question for me, because, as I said, I've been very, very fortunate that it was actually a friend of mine, my very best friend, still my very best friend, that said, why don't we go do this flying thing? And truthfully, I didn't have much interest. And my father said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, I always wanted to fly, but I'm busy and I don't have time with work. He said, you go, and if you don't like it, you get your license anyway and fly me around and I'll pay. He says, but if you like it, you gotta pay yourself. So I think I got the introductory flight out of him, and that was about it. And... but probably a couple really memorable parts of the puzzle was back really in, 1978, when I started my air service. Back then, that's prior to deregulation, Paul. So every licensed air carrier had to prove need and necessity in order to have a license to fly for hire, in order to operate a commercial business in Canada. And the business that I proposed was a little float operation in the Kawartha Lakes, kind of south of Halliburton, northeast of Toronto, if you're familiar with the area, east of the Muskokas. And there really wasn't anyone servicing that area. And there's a large tract of Crown land with some little lakes in it, some amazing fishing. And I have sort of fishing and hunting at my core. I love to fish and get out into the wilderness. As I said, I moved into that, and I went forward to establish my air service, and I wrote all my documents and my business case for proving that there was need and necessity. And back then, under that program, any existing carrier could oppose your application, and then you would have to go before kind of a tribunal of the government. And they would make a determination as to whether you could get your license or not. And so my application was opposed by actually Air Canada.
Seriously?
And and so I had to go to this tribunal, and I'm 19 at the time, Paul, and I put on my best Sunday clothes, and off to Ottawa I go to make my case for why I should get to do my air service. And I remember walking into this very ominous, very, you know, frightening room at the time as a young person. And and there's three individuals from Air Canada, all in business suits, looking ever so sharp, you know, and very mature. And I'm just some dumb kid, you know. And so I made my case. And Air Canada basically said, look, you know, you're going to give him a Class 4A license, which is to fly anyone in any size of aircraft anywhere in Canada. Now, A is the size of the aircraft, but it was a Class 4 charter. So Class 7 back then was specialty. That was sightseeing only or banner towing. But I was looking for a Class 4 because I wanted to do the fly-in fishing piece. And I could morph it into, you know, Air Canada 101, you know, I could duplicate it. And that was their case, is that I could take the license and I could fly anyone from anywhere in Canada with any base. And all I'd have to do would, you know, go up in the size of the aircraft. And so Air Canada did not feel there was a need for another air service in Canada at the time at a national level. And of course, and they were our national airline at the time. And we had some small regional carriers. And I remember listening to their dissertation on why I shouldn't be allowed to have my license. And I remember thinking about it. And as I listened, I thought, you know, boy, they're making a really good case. And so I said to the committee at the time, when it was my time to speak, and because oddly enough, they got to say why I shouldn't. And then I got to say why I should. And I remember saying, you know what? They made like a really great case. There probably is not a need to have another giant air carrier in Canada. But I'm not intending today to be a giant air carrier in Canada. And I just want to fly, you know, around this area of the Kawartha Lakes and fly into the various lodges and camping places that there were and show people this wonderful area and do some float plane flying. And I said, so listen, I'm really happy not to start my air service as long as Air Canada is prepared to put a float plane and serve that area. But there's nobody serving the area. Yeah. So if Air Canada doesn't want to put a, and if they want to put a float plane there, heck, put a float plane there. I'll fly it for them. But if they're not prepared to service the area, I don't think you should restrict all of those people in that area because Air Canada is worried about grand expectations from me. And the tribunal said, yeah, sounds good. Start your little air service. But that always struck with me going in the big room with the three top guns from Air Canada. So that was certainly one, Paul, and that was at the beginning. And it showed me, of course, that that vision was always lead. And that's what I had a vision for what to do in that area. And you know, the tribunal caught the vision and allowed me to have the license. And I have it pinned on my wall to this day, Paul. If you're by sometime, I'll show you that big official-looking document with my Class 4A license.
Wow. And all that as a 19-year-old, I mean, it's really amazing that you're able to keep your cool and still be able to present your case in a manner that was convincing to the tribunal and say, yes, but why not? So why is your service successful?
It was very successful, Paul. It was great. It was a lot of fun. I ran it for 10 years, and we had four remote camps in that area. I did charters up to Hudson's Bay a couple times a year. I still regularly go there and have some great relationships with a number of our Indigenous communities up there because of it, and really enjoyed it. But about 10 years in, and I was flying about 600 hours a year, year-round, we did, you know, some wonderful work for the Ministry of Natural Resources in the winter months, you know, moose surveys and deer surveys, and flew every waterway, draw a line from Sudbury across to North Bay, and follow the Ottawa River to Ottawa, and everything south of there, I flew every single waterway mapping osprey nests 1 year. And so we did some great work, and great work in Algonquin Park, scientific work, understanding the very beginnings of acid rain and the impact on the environment. And it was wonderful. It was very successful. But I want to tell you about 10 years in, it started to become a job. And I thought, wow, I love flying. I got to get out of this before I stop liking flying. Yes. And I don't know why. I never had any aspirations to go fly the big birds. And so I sold the air service at that point and moved into another segment of business that had a tie to aviation and was actually instrumental in getting car gas approved for use in little airplanes have some of the early designs for our double wall tanks that are at airports around the globe today, Paul. I have some patents on that through a company called Spectra Environmental that I operated next, and I had my little airplane and flew around and was very fortunate. So that's probably the second most notable piece, Paul, is the ability to fly because, I'd 10 years, 6,000 hours, multi-engine IFR commercial, and the training captain for my little company, of course, at the time. And we went all the way to a Group C airplane, which was like a big Norseman or big Otter, still single engine at the time. And but when I moved into the second phase of operating that business, being able to travel just made the world small, and it was very common for me to be on the phone and be talking to someone as a potential client. And I'd be checking the weather at the time I was talking to him, and I would say, well, I could see you tomorrow at 2. And they go, tomorrow at 2? He says, like, we're in Manitoba. I said, yeah, but it's nice weather, and it's a nice flight. And so I was able to really build that passion of aviation. And I probably could have made the sale over the phone, but it made a reason to go flying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
And did that with, so that was in that business, and I built that business up and sold that business, built another business up in live fire training, flew all over North America, teaching firemen to be firemen and building these live fire training units. And so that was probably and my kids, I have 4 kids and 4 children, and they grew up getting in the airplane, and we had, that was our summer holidays. What are we going to go see? Where are we going to fly? Yeah. Yeah, very fortunate. There's in a family of 6, in my immediate family, my wife and I have my license. My wife has her license. My oldest son and my youngest son have their license. And my oldest daughter is a manager at Billy Bishop Airport. My youngest son has his pilot's license, and he's very, very bright. But he wants to be a doctor, so we think he's the black sheep because he's not in aviation. And he's in a medical undergrad, and can't say enough about all my kids, But they grew up, we'd fly to Texas, let's go, and we'd see the country. And we've been very fortunate to, in my businesses, to travel overseas and in Europe, and had the opportunity to get in little airplanes and see Britain and see Ireland and see France from a bird's eye perspective. It's a real privilege. So that's probably the second thing. And I think probably the third and most notable is now here in Oshawa. I think part of the reason that we've been so successful here and that the airport's been so successful, because it's grown in the 10 years, 400,000 square feet of hangars. It was roughly about 40 airplanes when I came and 3 hangars. And now there's 400,000 more and 200 airplanes and 89,000 movements. Is because it really feeds into my background in both business development, in building and launching new businesses, but also my understanding of the industry, right? In being an air operator, being a commercial pilot, but also, being able to travel around. There's probably not an airport or aerodrome in Ontario I haven't been to, and many across Canada, from the big airports of Ottawa and I remember flying into Toronto Pearson in my little airplane back in the day, and when you could do that.
Yeah, me too.
So
1970 type of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And just the I think here today and working diligently to find the balance, so we understand the community perspective, and that's again something I think I bring to the table is being able to understand and empathize for the impacts that the airport does have, while also working with the community. One of the other highlights was I ran the Canadian Aviation Expo, and that was an aviation trade social. Think of a golf show and a home show.
Yeah.
Was the Canadian Aviation Expo, and I owned and operated that with my wife from 1999 until 2015. And in fact, that's how I came to know Oshawa. We moved it here in 1999, and that was great. I probably one of the highlights of my career, though, was I had one of these instructors, that worked for me one time, and he's now a pilot with Air Canada. But he was an instructor here at the time, and we were doing some training with him, and I was chatting with him about his flying career and how he got started. And he said, oh, you know, there used to be an air show, this aviation trade show in Oshawa called the Canadian Aviation Expo. And my grandfather brought me when I was 14.
Wow.
And so there you are. And that's what that show was all about. It was about bringing young people in and trying to impart some of my enthusiasm, you know, Paul. So that's a lot of fun.
Your enthusiasm is very contagious, which is very positive to anyone that has an opportunity to work with you. So really, Stephen, I'd like to thank you for a most interesting discussion today. And I'd like to thank our listeners to this and future podcasts that may come. And amazing, Stephen, as to your career and your background in history. And Oshawa, the city of Oshawa, is very fortunate to have you as their leader for the airport. So once again, thank you for participating.
Well, thanks very much, Paul. And maybe just in closing, the one thing I would add is that we just have a lot of amazing people in this industry. And it doesn't matter whether it's the millionaire flying his jet or the flight instructor or the Air Canada pilot. Everybody tends to put their pants on one leg at a time. And that is, I mean, they're really genuine people, and we see that with the managers. So I've been very fortunate to just work with some amazing airport managers here in Ontario through my role on the board of the Airport Management Council of Ontario, and now on the Canadian Airports Council at a national level. It just attracts the best people, you know. So I really encourage people, if they're looking for a great industry, just to come on in, because it really is just a wonderful industry full of great people like yourself, Paul. So thanks very much for the time to chat today. It's been a real pleasure, and I wish you all the success.
Thank you.